Hi everyone, this is Lit Radio Podcast and I'm your host, Thea. Today I'm joined by Brian Raymer and Magnus Lindqvist, authors of How to Make AI Useful, Moving Beyond the Hype to Real Progress in Business, Society and Life. Brian, PhD, is a research scientist at MIT Center for Transportation and Logistics, and a global expert on the intersection of AI, technology, human behavior, mobility, and public policy. Magnus is a Swedish futurologist and transporter known for blending insights from business, science, and the arts to challenge how we think about the future. He is a sought-after global speaker and author of multiple books. In How to Make AI Useful, Brian and Magnus show how to harness AI's potential from automating the tedious to amplifying creativity for real progress long after today's bubble bursts. Hi, Brian and Magnus. It's a great pleasure to have you with us on Lit Radio Podcast. How are you today?
Fantastic.
Terrific. And happy to be here.
Great. And great to have you. And obviously, Magnus, you've been on the podcast for a few times already. So it's great to have you back. And it's great to also introduce Brian to the Lit family. So my first question to you before we begin talking about your book is, could you tell us a bit about your background and how you began your work in the exploration of AI? Brian, we can start with you.
Sure, Taya. I actually began my exploration of AI in particular back when I was a grad student nearly a quarter century ago, when I took a number of computer science courses and AI courses back in what we consider today the dark ages, and used AI methods such as neural nets and genetic algorithms, when we linked a bunch of computers together to try to solve things. Through my research over the past several decades, I've used AI sporadically to solve lots of interesting problems. Deep neural nets were a focus of work for a while, computer vision algorithms in lots of different ways. More recently, integrating large language models into our work. But my work has really been largely focused on a real socio-technical issue of how we as humans integrate with advanced mobility technologies, automated driving, assisted driving, and the like. And automated driving in specific was predicated on the advancements of AI and the synergies between today's AI space race and the promises of automated vehicles in 5 years. And again, it's been 5 years for a while, are just so synergistic. So today, we sit here talking about AI, which is, kind of the modern day race to Mars. And we think about the magic of AI and how it really links with so many other social technical problems of the day. It's not about the technology. It's about how we as humans interact, use, leverage, and find usefulness in that technology. And that's kind of the story of how I've gotten to where we are today.
Interesting. And Magnus, what about you?
Well, I'm more agnostic. I mean, I'm a generalist, an outsider. I think in our book, I describe me as the fox, and then I guess that would make Brian the technology hedgehog. So it came across my radar 3 or 4 years ago with the launch of GPT-2, the second model. And for a long time, most people remember we were much more into things like NFTs, non-fungible tokens. There was talk about the metaverse. Facebook even changed their name to Meta. There wasn't that much talk about AI, even as late as 2020, 2021. And then it just exploded onto the scene. And like many others, I've done my best to keep up and learn from people like Brian.
Great. And what's interesting in all of that is how did you the two of you came together to work on the book? How did you meet?
Do you want to tell her, darling?
Surely. So we were both invited to speak at Belron's Best of Belron event in June of 2024. I remember meeting Magnus just outside of the hotel on the way to dinner. And we happened to sit next to each other over dinner, and he asked me this semi-loaded question. I'm thinking about writing a book around AI. What do you think about AI? And I might have had a few glasses of red wine, and I think it's written very elegantly into the book at that point. But yeah, I had just given a keynote a few months earlier in Sweden for the folks at AI Sweden. Mats Nordlund challenged me in the winter of 2024 to say something new about AI. So very rarely in my sphere do you get the opportunity to sit back and create a whole new keynote address and really think about what do you want to tell the world. And following that conversation that I shared with Magnus, one of my long-term Swedish friends, amazing how everything goes back to Sweden. It's amazing how it all goes back to Ola too, because we both have good friends all in Sweden. Ola Bernström told me, said, you know, every leader in a Fortune 500 company needs the story, hear the story you just told. And as Magnus and I began to talk over dinner and that conversation pursued over time, our ability to work together and amplify off each other to create something special really came to life. And I don't think there's any black and white when it comes to AI. As one of my early slides went, AI is an opinion. It's a darn good opinion. And I think that the book that we wrote together really is a great opinion on AI. And we'll see how true it comes over the decades ahead.
I'd just like to add, Brian, you mentioned Best of Belron. Most people know that company by either the name Carglass or in the US, Safelite. And they organize biannually the world championships of windscreen repair. So they have all of these teams competing in how fast and eloquently or beautifully they can repair glass on a car. I mean, it's magnificent. So that's the backdrop. And I'd just like to add, I mean, we were at dinner and I was a bit nervous because my speech was due the next day. So I think I had like a couple of glasses of tap water. You'd already done your speech, Brian. So you were, if not three sheets to the wind, you were on fire. And let me tell all our listeners here today that when Brian is on fire, it's like a beautiful intellectual firework of things that both make a lot of sense and some that make less sense. You were shooting from the hip about Amazon's ability to compete in all spaces, the promise and letdown of self-driving cars. I mean, I was seduced, intellectually speaking. And I think it was, I actually emailed you a couple of days later. I just wanted to interview you for, I was thinking about writing a book about AI, just like everybody else did. And I was like, I just want some of that Brian energy in the book. And then you said, have you ever co-written something? And I think I lied and said, yes. I managed to like snare you, tie you into this project. And here we are, 9 months later, after a long and cumbersome pregnancy.
And Magnus, it's elegantly stated. And I just need to add is that, you know, I am very good shooting off the hip. And I was taught by my colleague and boss, Joe Coughlin, that you need to speak off the cuff. You need to be comfortable with the material and share. The hard part of that is, and where I love the teamwork, is that, you know, I can shoot and come up with framing ideas really quickly, but man, can you put them into elegant words? I know you're literally so skilled.
In our book, I've likened us to the English 1980s pop duo, the Pet Shop Boys, who are also, I think they're still around, but they also have that very fruitful relationship where somebody's behind the keyboard and the other one behind the mic. And I think that's us.
Yeah. So it's a big, you know, opportunity to shout out to the folks at Belron, because this book exists because of their conference and their ability to get their employees to compete around windshield repair and replacement. And the marriage of the two of us.
Car glass replaced. Sorry. Okay. Next question.
That's all right. Yeah, you did definitely created a great team together. And well, my next question is why you decided to write the book, which I think you kind of already touched on, but could you expand on that a little bit?
Yeah, so let me begin because the project began in my head. I mean, writing a book is marginally more profitable than doing pottery. I've learned over 15 years of doing it, but it reaps big intellectual and spiritual rewards. As somebody once said, I write books to find out what I'm thinking. And obviously, being a little bit late to the AI party, I was like, how can I organize my research about this topic? And how can I attempt to say something new and fresh? So that was sort of all I had, and I started gathered some notes and thoughts and read most of the literature that was already out there. And when I met Brian, your background in, the intersection of society and technology, I think fairly quickly led to the question that you post, but how do we make it useful? And that came very early in the project, and that became the question that we wrestled with. So that was the original birth of the project. And I know, Brian, if you want to add to that and say where things came from you.
And so, as I began, a little before I met Magnus, to think about, okay, what makes AI useful? And I thought about it for, through the message of what did I want to share with the AI community in Sweden. It begins to move beyond the technology. It's about how we as humans evolve with the technology. As one of the talking points has become, it's about co-pilot versus autopilot. It's how do we work with technology? It's assistive driving versus automated driving. We have a role to play with this technology. It's not going to eviscerate all jobs. It's going to change things. The question, as David Dixon at MIT raised in some of our interviews, is will we let AI change us? It's as much of a human problem as it is a technology problem. We invest billions, if not trillions, of dollars in making better AI algorithms. But the social technical factors of how we as humans are going to benefit from this, how businesses are going to leverage this in a capitalistic way, and how governments are going to guide this are just so underfunded and underappreciated. So the true success of AI to me is less about OpenAI developing a new model that beats the last. It's about how I'm creating usefulness in my businesses, relationships, in my life, in society. And I think there's huge opportunity there, but it's just, it's beat down by this tech marketing scheme that we live within.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think you ask a very interesting question in the book, which is AI actually useful? And if it is, for whom?
Well, let's usefulness is the word where human meets machine, right? It's not difficult to try to speculate as to what a machine can do and will be able to do. It can drive fast, or it can lift heavy things, or it can quickly calculate things. And very often, AI is still framed as a technological phenomenon. I mean, it's that consumes a lot of data and can outperform human ingenuity. But usefulness is obviously something that we humans value, and it's very hard to predict. I mean, one of the killer apps of electricity, apart from air conditioning units and electrical stoves, was the electrical guitar, which fundamentally changed music and created new genres like heavy metal. And it came later, and it was almost accidentally discovered. So we realized fairly quickly, me and Brian, that looking at AI through a lens of utility and usefulness for humans would help us. And I don't know if you, Brian, want to take the listener through a few of the areas that we look at, in both the wow phase and maybe later.
So I think when we think about the oh my God, what can this do side of AI, and we break that up into three components in the book. One is AI for doing. That's quite frankly the old-fashioned automation side. AI is wonderful at helping to automate more simple, boring tasks. Okay. And we can all think about many things every day of the week. Me, it's usually my email. For others, it's vacuuming or mowing the lawn, where a little automation can take a little boring stuff out of life and free some time up to do other things. And that other those other things have huge value. So I love, as I travel around Europe more and more, to see all the robotic lawn cutting machines out there every morning chopping away. That's AI at its finest. Reducing work that quite frankly doesn't have to be human. The other area is AI as creator. We are thrust with the use of AI, whether that's ChatGPT or other approaches, to create new. That's art, that's music, that's design, that's even software code at times, where the agents are creating new for us. I was experimenting the other day in trying to create a new graphic, and let's just say the chatbots aren't quite there yet. I wasn't not impressed, even when you told it in ultra simple terms, to augment this by just adding a quote here. It couldn't even handle that. So it's amazing, how advanced in some sense these systems are, and how, quite frankly, dumb they are in other senses.
But let me add
But the
something
re
there, Brian, because I think a lot of people have been let down by AI's ability to create a finished product, whether it's a text or a piece of art. But what's a utility in there, I've noticed, is both exploration. Like, give me 10 words that rhyme with can, or give me a different alternative ending to this paragraph. Or give me 18 different colors that this logo could be in. So that kind of exploration that would be fairly cumbersome to do by head or hand, but that comes fairly quickly. I've noticed that as a kind of riffing agent, as an ideator. The other thing, which is almost so basic we tend to ignore it, there's nothing more daunting than the blank page, right? It's what keeps you procrastinating in the morning and putting off the project until the next day. And AI is, in essence, a blank page annihilator. You can start with something. It could be ugly, bad, stupid, but you get past that first daunting blank page hurdle.
So Magnus, you're talking about the third part beautifully. It's AI as assistant. And that's really where I think both of us believe the true magnificent utility of AI has the most potential. It's helping me hone, it's my personal communications team. But what's key is, while AI can do all of these things for us, it's only offering me a really strong opinion. An opinion that is built by humans, programmers, information and content written by humans, with many of the flaws that we as humans have. We hallucinate. Why wouldn't we expect AI to hallucinate? So AI is an incredible assistant, capable of making us better. The big questions that we begin to dive in a little bit into the book, and I think are huge societal questions: how do we channel this automation? Because that's really what AI is doing. It's automating the ability to find or tune information at a times a microscope level and at times a macroscope level. How do we tune that automation into our lives, where humans, by their very nature, are lazy creatures? Many humans, not all, look at automation and say, hey, I can have a beer and sit in front of the TV, especially here in the US on football days. Others, and this is where I think the really unique part here, are going to look at this automation and this AI and this capability and say, oh my God, I can use this for my bet to enhance my capabilities and enhance what I can produce and do more. So if I look forward with my periscope, I see the tools that we are creating today accelerating many parts of society to do more, to make us as humans better. I also see the desperate need for guardrails, where many organizations are beginning to talk about the context of work slop, where lazier elements of their organizations are just asking the AI to create something for me and not even proofread this. This is something that needs to become intolerable in society today, almost politically and socially unacceptable. In essence, AI is a tool to improve what I can do is where we want to be, not AI just to replace everything I should be doing. So honing information, taking 10 pages of text and turning that into a honed 5-page essay. Yeah, that's great. Read 5 times over back and forth by the AI and me. But just turning this into producing more information and more regression to the mean is I think what we as a society are going to have to wrestle with to get beyond, to find the true usefulness in this technology.
Yeah. And what you've described is the first wow phase of the development of AI in the book. But Brian, are we now in this stage of the development of AI?
I think we've transitioned into what we call the woe phase, where the red flags are starting to pop up all over the place. Those are governments saying, oh my God, how can I allow this? And this can be both the use of the AI tools as well as the potential infringements on copyright and privacy. And again, where's the data coming from? As well as how is this going to change employment in society? So we are all beginning to wrestle with these big picture questions of, oh my God, what can this do? Can we survive if the workforce shifts? And I'm, as I think about the woe phase here, I'm not of the mind that we are going to all of a sudden not be employed. I am of the mind we are going to dramatically change employment, probably over the long haul for the better. Well, like any major technological transformational change, there are winners, there are losers, and we hate to be on the losing side. So we want to dig in our, many of us want to dig in our heels. But at the end of the day, we are going to shift the nature of work. And that's what automation does. It doesn't replace work. It really shifts the nature of it. So through this woe phase, we begin to think about, okay, how does society really need to change? Where does society need to change? And how do we begin thinking about the context of guardrails to make sure we're making good societal decisions over the long haul? And I think that's where, you know, we need to be moving, because technology often evolves faster than institutions. And so the technology is moving forward at race speed, and the institutions are trying to catch up and often overreact. Oh my God, how can I allow this in my jurisdiction? We see that with automated vehicles all over these days. There's currently a ballot initiative in Massachusetts to try to ban automated vehicles. How can I allow this? So we got to think about the human element about this, because it's not the AI, the technology that's going to fail. It's our ability to integrate ourselves with this and the transformational changes that need to occur. As we really begin to wrangle with how much change is on the horizon and how much each and every one of us is willing to accept that change. So very individual, very cultural, very geographic, even if you go into the United States or Europe.
Yeah. In the near-term future, I think we should also add, Brian, both the whole kind of bring your own power, which is happening right now, and that the big AI giants and data centers are forced to buy up and create their own energy generation facilities. I think the most famous or infamous example is the Amazon purchase of Three Mile Island, the nuclear power plant in the US. And we don't, this is obviously the first phase of a new technology, which we know from history is always inelegant and cumbersome and wasteful. The second thing, and perhaps the thing most people are thinking about this week, is the financial bubble territory of it. We have companies investing in themselves through proxies. We have an OpenAI having, you know, this very promiscuous partnerships where they invest trillions and have trillions invested back in them. I mean, it very much looks like historical financial bubbles, But what me and Brian talk about in the book is that, well, when a bubble pops, it disappears. The subprime mortgage crisis that led to the Lehman Brothers meltdown, that was a bubble. Real estate bubbles. There's nothing left. But this is more like a balloon. It will certainly deflate, but the infrastructure will be there and the technology and its promise will be there, similar to what the internet was like after the dot-com crash. So I think we will see a much more interesting version of AI being born in the wake of the financial collapse, which undoubtedly will happen sometime in the near future.
And I think, Magnus, what you're hitting on is really the financial engineering that's going on in the background, because these companies are going to shift around dramatically. There are elements of what they're doing that are going to win, and there's elements that are going to lose. And they're creating financial networks, much like Wall Street has derived financial products for years, to create an ecosystem that goes up and down in ways that we can't even predict at this point. Predicting where AI ends up would be a masterpiece, Michelangelo level.
But also, Brian, I'm reminded there, the wise quote, you can never predict the invention of the wheel, because if you could, you would already have predicted it.
done. Yeah, that's a really good way to be thinking about things. I see this evolution of AI continuing. We are all going to have a different relationship with technology, much like the internet has changed our relationship. But through this wow phase, the biggest piece to me is it is a disruptor to the Internet of Things as we know it. It is changing the very nature today of how we seek and retrieve information from the internet. The internet is fueled by ad revenue. Little bots in the background bidding for our attention and chiming for what ad to throw in front of us. The current trends in AI today are disrupting that at mass scale. So the winners and the losers in this race are going to be huge corporate shifts in revenue. As the ad revenue shifts around from what's defined the Google era of clicking and searching to the synthesis era of what AI is providing today. And this is just one of many steps along the way to finding the true usefulness of AI in the future. So there is so many trillions of dollars to be won and lost here. In so much of how we interact with information that is going to change around, I think it's going to be fun to watch. And I'm hoping, for one, that the advertisement side loses for a change, because I'd rather pay $100 a month for access to information than watch $100 worth of advertisements clouding my screen and vying for my attention. And I think a lot of us would love that subscription model. Thinking much more of the model of Amazon Prime versus advertisements, advertisements, advertisements. So it'll be interesting to see how the Internet of Things shifts here as AI is augmenting how we digest and we experience content in real time through the phases we are today.
Yeah, so it's all about the question whether we're going to let AI change us, which is what you're trying to answer in the book.
Yeah, that
Yeah,
question
and
came
it's
to
that.
us in an interview with David Dixon from MIT, who, correct me, Ryan, he's the head of AI and learning and AI and education.
E-learning.
E-learning. And hold on.
And go for it, Magnus.
Yeah. So we had an interview with him, and he talked about all the promises of AI and, the ability to bring the best kind of teaching and learning tools to everyone around the world. A personal tutor, perfectly adapted to the needs of every student, whether they are in Botswana or Borlänge in the north of Sweden. As he was speaking, we realized that we have been here once before. We realized what people talked what people used to say about the internet and things like YouTube, right? YouTube would bring, the world's best teacher, the world's best math teacher to the plains of Africa or the mountains of Europe and so on. That would be, it would promises like limitless learning. Facebook would bring in, the obliteration of borders. We would be connected, one happy family. The early days of the internet, it was viewed as this hippie commune of just free stuff. Information wants to be free. Fast forward, and we see today that most schools have either already prohibited smartphone use or are in the process of trying to outlaw smartphone use for students. We have a number of countries around the world that have made social media platforms illegal below the age of 15, 16. We've seen a massive backlash, or I think the word should be techlash, over the past couple of years. And there's really no guarantee that the institutions, while mildly interested in what AI could provide, decide ultimately to just regulate them away into oblivion. So that we don't let AI change the way we work, live, or thrive.
And look, I have a daughter in sophomore year of high school here in the US who's in history frustrated right now. And I keep telling her, history repeats itself. That's why it's such an important part of high school education. We look at education in particular being upended by AI and how students are leveraging AI in the classroom. To write things, and we need to be thinking about how we reinvent AI with these tools. I believe strongly that students need to learn the information, but they also need to learn to search for information and find things that would never have been possible without these tools. So I had a project I was working on a couple of days ago where I had to find a document that I knew existed somewhere in the world, and I'm querying for it with Google for a half an hour and cannot find this darn document. It's somewhere in the web, and I knew, I kind of knew the relative date range, kind of knew the topic area. I go over to ChatGTP and I dial in exactly the same Google query into ChatGTP, and it pulls the document right up. Because I was looking and framing this is in one framework, and it was just framed in a few different words in the actual document. And ChatGTP is a, such a capable of extrapolating meaning that, oh my God, you can go back in time in ways that you would never have fathomed years ago. So how do we use that in education? How do we ensure that students are learning appropriately? Like a colleague on campus the other day who was joking that she went back to a pen and paper exam with minimal notes and writing on hand. And the students hated her for it because they actually had to think about things in ways that they just don't do in their homework. So we need to reinvent ourselves, and we need to be willing to change and knowing that each of these changes is going to have positives and negatives, and how do we look for the overall benefit for life and society over the long haul?
Absolutely. And now let's move on to the final phase that you cover in the book, which is the growth stage. So could you tell us what would that stage look like, but also what kind of challenges and obstacles we would need to overcome as a society and also as businesses to be able to actually get to that final phase of development?
Starting here, I think that a lot of the early thinking around the growth phase came from my experiences in self-driving cars, where in the US and lots of other places in the world, you have a patchwork legislative systems of just trying to fill the holes so things can happen. In the US, we have a saying going here, you have 50 states moving in 50 different directions. So we just keep patching and patching and patching and patching, trying to allow things without really taking a step back and a step up to systematically review strategically how do we thread technologies more effectively in our lives. I received an award last week from the Human Factors, or this week from the Human Factors and Ergonomics Society. It was the AR Lauer Safety Award, and I was suggested that I give a statement and a vision to the crowd upon acceptance. And my vision was, we need to step back and step up more frequently to look at how the things we are doing, the technologies we are creating, fit into this patchwork of life, and to strategically talk about that. So we are so boiled down to the tactical aspect of how my little widget fits into the corner, we fairly rarely stretch forward into the strategic phase of redefining what that corner looks like. And for AI to be truly useful over the long haul, I think both Magnus and I began to think about, hey, we need to step back and reinvent strategically how AI is going to fit seamlessly into society.
There are a couple of things there. If you again, drawing the parallel with the rise of the internet, imagine 30 years ago that I would tell you that in the future you would pay for a London Underground ticket by tapping your phone on a metal barrier. I mean, the level of abstraction for that. First, you'd think of your phone, which was then, you know, cord. You know, you had a cord. It's usually in your hallway at home. You're going to bring that with you and tap. What do you mean? Just hit it, or what does that even mean? What metal barrier? There's so many levels of abstractions. Each one pointing to that the revolution of paying by phone, smartphones, online payments, online banking, all of these things was not one invention. It was not like, Eureka, the World Wide Web. It was, you know, 19 inventions and 55 battles. And in the book, me and Brian distinguish between the activity of patching, which is when you kind of short-term improvise just to try to get something to happen. And this is very much the skunk work phase that we're in right now. We have these companies trying out different solutions built upon old infrastructures of laptops and smartphones. There will most likely be an AI-first device. It won't need a keyboard, maybe not even a screen, just maybe a microphone for you to speak in and then for it to interact with other things. Secondly here, I think every company that has been experimenting with agentic AI noticed the number of legacy systems that can't really talk to each other yet. And all these things will be invented, but that's very much a kind of analog process of trial and error. There are people in basements and penthouses right now trying out their little patch software or their little piece of code which will enable things to talk through legacy systems, but that thing can't be rushed. So we're in the grow phase. We will be in this kind of patchy experimental grow phase for a while, and then later on, and it's likely that it can take 30 years, we will pave society for an AI first world.
Yeah, and I think it will be very interesting for everyone to see what happens from here on. But as a conclusion to this very insightful conversation, can I ask both of you, considering where we are today in the development of AI, could you share with our listeners a few tips or guidance on what are the most useful benefits of AI at the moment that can be utilized by leaders or even in society?
So I really like the thought of AI's power, real true power today, as an amplification. Much like the electric guitar, the computer, the smartphone we've talked about, the biggest value is helping people do what they do only better. I think that to me is the piece society needs to really stick with. Now that may change 30, 40, 50, 60 years from now, but AI is amplifier. I think that individuals need to feel really supported about leveraging the tools that they have today to play, much like kids play in a sandbox, explore, create. Begin to use these tools and understand these tools as opinions that can help guide our directions. You know, as Magnus said, write a new ending to a paragraph, create a full view bullet points. Tell me about something synergistically that I would otherwise have looked at three articles and only captured a few elements from. But at the end of the day, consumers, businesses, policy, and the like need to remember that AI is regression to the mean, built upon information we have created. So it may very well be a really good opinion and one that is a little better than average, but truly is not the perfection that humans can create. Because humans think in the gray and out of the box beyond what regression can do. We think we create magic. AI is not magic. It's fundamentally really, really complex statistics summarizing elegantly information that we've already created. So thinking forward, we're still going to have to create a lot of magic, but AI can help amplify that magic in new ways.
I would like to add to this because there is one area where we humans seek out mean reversal, and that's psychotherapy. We seek the help of a therapist to know that what we're going through is okay, that we are normal, that this too shall pass. And I used to chat GPT as a psychotherapist a year ago. And I've tried all versions of psychotherapy, Freudian, Jungian, all kinds of things. And it's, very expensive, usually require a long trip, a commute to a psychologist's office somewhere. Here I could sit and just type or talk. And I noticed that the fairly bland tone of voice, which is so irritating in a creative context, became a soothsayer. Became a friend, and it really helped me for significantly less money than a therapist would have cost me.
And that's a great example, Magnus. I mean, I use ChatGTP constantly to help hone the tone of emails, of information for different audiences, and it provides so much strategic suggestions that you can weigh. Do I like this? That's a great word to put in here, and thinking out of that box, and making information more acceptable to different audiences. And sometimes you want it right, sometimes you want it left, sometimes you want it up and down, but it can help you move things around in ways that are so supportive. And do that in seconds in your home in ways. I think AI is going to transform medicine, lawyers, financial advice. We'd like to all believe that we are working with the best, and the reality is not everybody can be the best. Being better than average is actually a huge accomplishment.
Yeah, fascinating. Thank you very much for sharing all of that, Brian and Magnus. And obviously, I would encourage our listeners to grab a copy of How to Make AI Useful so they can read more about your insights regarding the development of AI. But thank you very much for your time today. I've really enjoyed our conversation. Thank you so much for joining us today. Make sure you keep an eye on our social media at Lit Publishing on LinkedIn, X, Instagram, TikTok, and Facebook for more information about new books and podcasts with thought leaders. See you next time on Lit Radio Podcast.